Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to the Bergenomics podcast, where my experts and I demystify current topics through the paradigm of economics that relate to your standard of living. I'm your host, Ross McDowell. Plumbers and your local general practitioner play an important role in all of our lives. Only the most academically gifted achieve the entry scores required to study the extraordinarily expensive medical courses to become doctors. The same academic level and hex debt isn't required to become a plumbing apprentice. You would then expect doctors to earn substantially more than plumbers, but over recent decades, their income levels have converged to be a lot closer. This raises the question, on what basis does our society set the incomes of various vocations? And do those incomes reflect the importance of the job a person performs? After all, I'm sure we would all be willing to pay a lot more for a doctor to save our life than a plumber to fix a plumbing issue. Joining me today is a leading expert in labour economics, Professor Jeff Borland from Melbourne University. Professor Borland has been a consultant to the OECD, the International Monetary Fund, the Productivity Commission, the Fair Work Commission, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, and three Commonwealth departments, Employment, Health and Community Services. In 2018, Professor Borland was appointed by the Minister for Jobs and Small Business as a member of the expert panel to make recommendation on Australian employment systems. In the same year, he was a member of the consultation group formed by the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to make recommendations on revised employment targets. Jeff, welcome to Bergenomics.
Thanks, Ross. Thanks very much for inviting me to your podcast.
Now, Jeff, before we get on to the doctors and the plumbers,
yep.
Let's just, one group comes out as being a very obvious group to start our conversation. Venture capitalists, who are a group who works solely for profit, are more highly remunerated than most life-saving surgeons. I know that. A very close friend of mine is one of the leading, or was one of the leading, thoracic surgeons doing artificial heart transplants, and I've also got several friends that are venture capitalists. They earn 20 times more per year than one of the world's leading heart transplant surgeons. So on what basis are vocations or professions remunerated in our society?
Well, I guess to an economist, everything starts off with and comes down to supply and demand. We usually think of wages as being determined on the supply side by the preferences people have for working jobs they do, and in what they give up to be able to do that job. So the amount of education they need, the kind of conditions that they have to work in to do the job. And on the demand side, it's about the value of output they produce. But I guess following on from the comparison you're making there, important to say that's a value according to the market, not necessarily according to the way society might step back from what people are paid and think of as the value that they're contributing to society overall. Yeah, those broad factors of supply and demand, do a pretty good job of telling us sort of around what kind of pay levels people will have. Yeah, if you think of medical specialists who you mentioned, we know they have to give up a lot to work in those jobs. In terms of the years of education they spend, highly pressured sort of usually jobs as well, and we know that notwithstanding your comparison, we know that sort of the value of what they produce is high for society. The fact that they can save lives, the fact that they can have such a big impact on people's health. So demand and supply factors would tell us that, look, medical practitioner specialists are going to be relatively well remunerated. Compared to, say, wait staff at local cafe, they're not giving up as much to work in that job in terms of the need for training and education, and while we might like going to the cafe to get a meal or get takeaway coffee, the value of what's being produced there isn't as high, say, by comparison with medical specialists. So we'd expect those jobs to be sort of less well paid. But supply and demand sort of tell us in general the kind of levels that we'd expect people to be paid, but they don't tie it down exactly. I think another factor that's really important is the bargaining power that workers have compared to their employers, or compared to who's buying their services. And one of the big things that determines bargaining power is the forces of supply and supply and demand. So where you end up sort of for pay of medical practitioners, specialists, where you end up for pay of wait staff, depends a lot on the actual levels of supply and demand as well. So, I mean, one really pertinent example at the moment, I think, is actually with respect to wait staff and the hospitality sector. So we've gone from a situation before COVID-19 where the news was filled with stories about wage theft against people working in the hospitality sector. We've now gone to a situation during COVID where we're hearing stories about $1,000 sign-on bonuses for people to work in cafes. And so you say, wow, wages in the hospitality sector have really increased. What's going on here? And I think it's all to do with the balance of supply and demand. What had happened in Australia in the decade or so before COVID hit is that we'd had big increases in the number of working holiday makers in Australia, big increases in the number of international students. They tend to work a lot in part-time jobs in sort of a small number of occupations to do with hospitality, food trades. And so we'd had a relatively big increase in the supply of workers to work in those jobs compared to there was certainly growing demand for people to work in hospitality, but nowhere near as much as supply. So we had a lot of downward pressure on wages. Take away those working holiday makers and a lot of the international students, and suddenly supply is, gone down, and so wages are being pushed up. There's sort of these kind of underlying forces we think of on the supply side: people preferences for doing jobs and how much they give up to do those jobs.
Okay, let me ask you a question then. So if it goes to supply and demand purely, yep, the economic forces of supply and demand, if there are enough surgeons but there's not enough wait staff, would eventually the wait staff earn the same as the surgeon?
Well, you'd need a pretty extreme sort of imbalance in supply and demand for wait staff to drive their pay sort of up
And if you were going to pay wait staff the same as surgeons, then the cost of the food at the restaurant would go through the roof and nobody would want to shop there.
Exactly. I think that's the point. You're going to have what economists would call sort of equilibrating adjustments and that before you got to that stage, because of the fact that you don't need to train for all these years to be a wait staff. Once the wage starts increasing up towards medical specialists, you're going to have lots of people saying, wow, this is the job for me, which is going to push the wage, push the wage back down sort of. So even if you kind of could snap your fingers and say, oh, wow, I'm going to create a situation where we need we need 50,000 wait staff, but there's only 10 people at the moment who could do it. And you say, wow, that's really going to push the wages up. Pretty quickly, there'd be stuff that would force you back, those wages back down sort of, because of the fundamental differences between those jobs.
So people would start swapping out of other employment because they're going to get paid a whole lot more to serve coffee.
It's not like everyone has exactly the same sort of wage at which they're willing to work in different occupations. People are similar enough sort of that if suddenly you triple or quadruple the wage that you're paying to wait staff, there's going to be enough people who kind of think of that as, yeah, that's an okay sort of job, that they're going to shift towards doing that job because they're going to think, wow, the net benefit that I get from working in this job, I might not regard it sort of as satisfying as my ideal job and that, but boy, it's paying me four times as much, so I'm going to work there for a while, at least while I can get this sort of return on it.
How easy is it for labour to shift around within our economy when maybe their industry begins to decline? Let me give you an example here. I recently did a podcast on electric vehicles, and if we look at all of the facts and the figures, we're still going to have petrol vehicles on the road in 2050, but it's going to be predominantly electric vehicles. Now, the Bureau of Stats tells us that currently there are 352,000 automotive and engineering trade workers that are at risk when we go to electric vehicles. What do 352,000 people do within the next couple of decades. Maybe some are too old to be retrained, or they don't want to be retrained. How does that mobility work?
Yeah, well, it all really comes down to transferability of skills. It comes down to any worker will have a particular set of skills, and it's about how transferable those skills are to other jobs. And those skills can be generic type skills, literacy, numeracy, interpersonal skills, and so on, or they can be really job specific skills, like you know how to manufacture some part sort of for particular vehicle, or you've got expertise in designing sort of particular aspects of a petrol driven vehicle. So the ease with which people can transfer really depends on sort of the skills they have, and then the other jobs that are available sort of out there. So if you've got one type of job which mainly relies on generic type skills, basic levels of literacy and numeracy, sort of being able to talk to other people and that, then if there's one area that was demanding those skills that goes into decline, pretty likely there are going to be other areas that are kind of demanding those skills as well. But the case you're giving is a bigger issue sort of for adjustment. The idea that you've got a group of workers who have specific skills that have been highly valued in doing some particular type of job, but then that area of economic activity is just declining, and those skills aren't going to be as valuable, say, and may not be transferable to other jobs. And so then you've got to think of ways to try and... Adjustment occurs in all different ways. I guess the example I just gave, some people lose a job, easy to find another job. But other people, as in that type of case, potentially harder to move to other jobs.
So what about if, their electric cars do still require some degree of servicing and repair, a lot less than an internal combustion engine car. So maybe a lot of these 352,000 people will want to remain in the industry looking after electric cars. That would mean all of a sudden you've got this massive amount of labour going into an area that doesn't require that amount of labour anymore. That's going to push wages down, is it?
It may not. I guess what it's more likely to do, I think, is that if there's all those people who wanted to work in that area, employers will sort of start off by choosing the people who they want most, and then the other people will have to decide, well, do I still try and stay in the queue to get a job like that, or do I try and use my skills sort of in some other type of job rather than being unemployed? If the employers realise that there's this big queue of people who sort of potentially want to work in it, then they may start to try and pay lower wages. But again, then you have the adjustment happening that we talked about before, that if the wages get pushed down too far, then even if I'm thinking, well, look, I kind of like to stay in the motor vehicle industry and I've got these skills that are appropriate, but if the wage starts going down too much, then you think about, well, okay, I think it's actually better to retrain for another type of job where the wages are going to be higher. But I think it's a really, really important policy issue you raise there, because that type of change that you're describing there, it's happening all the time in the economy. In the 90s, for example, we had the shakeout in textile manufacturing. Passenger motor vehicles, I guess, was also during that period. It's been ongoing, footwear as well. So that this type of structural change is ongoing. Of course, at the same time, we've got these new areas of employment opening up, sort of, which offer new jobs. The problem is that there's not always sort of a one-to-one correspondence between the skills which aren't being needed and the skills which are being needed. We've done, I think, a really good job in Australia in the last 40 years of training people for the new jobs. In the early 1980s, 5% of people of the workforce had university degrees. Now it's 30%. Why is that? Well, it's because we're creating all these jobs which require those higher levels of skills. Where we haven't done such a good job, I think, is assisting workers who are being displaced because their areas in the economy are the declining areas. And so I think that's an area where we can get a lot better in policy. Those workers who you talked about, the vehicle workers, kind of really work out what are the skills these workers have sort of that can be transferable to the rest of the economy. How do we need to really assist them to build on those skills that they've got, to find other jobs? I think we've done a really good job with putting new workers into the new jobs. I don't think traditionally we've done such a good job sort of allowing workers who are being displaced to adjust. And that shows up in the data. As you said, if you're displaced, you're probably going to be older. And so We know that if you become unemployed as an older worker, the financial cost is, you know, is much higher than if you become unemployed as a younger worker.
Okay. Now, let's get to our core question. Should plumbers earn a similar amount to doctors? A comparison previously used in the media, and let me say I don't have a vendetta against plumbers. Were you saying your dad was a plumber?
Yeah, my dad was a plumber.
Okay.
I used to go to work with him in that, so.
Okay, right. So you and I may disagree on this. Okay, so once plumbers were part of the trades, an old-fashioned, slightly demeaning socioeconomic term. The trades needed unions to protect them from exploitation, but now many would say tradies are in a more powerful position and have similar trappings of success as your local GP. Tradies have got television shows that they now are the subjects of. There are even underpants that you buy at the supermarket called tradies. So in terms of doctors and tradies, I've got some figures based on people that I've spoken to. The standard cost for a medical degree from Melbourne University on their website is $335,000. The student's got to repay that debt. That qualification leads to general practice where your gross earnings can vary greatly. The GPs I've spoken to say that most GPs are earning themselves, not the gross income from patients, they're earning themselves between $190,000 and $250,000. This income is limited by the government Medicare rebate, which is pegged at $86 per consultation. The general practitioner has to pay thousands of dollars in professional indemnity insurance, up to $6,000. They have to pay a percentage of their fees to the medical practice manager, up to 30%, and the Australian Tax Office are able to account for 100% of their earnings. Now, comparing that to a plumbing apprentice, it doesn't cost him money to get educated. He gets paid during his apprenticeship $170,000. That doesn't include loadings and overtime, etc. And the taxpayers contribute $20,000 in his first year as being a plumbing apprentice. $20,000 is equivalent to 555 Medicare rebate consultations. Now, I spoke with four sole tradesmen plumbers, so guys working on their own, who earned between $130,000 to $240,000 being a plumber. However, unlike GPs, they can charge whatever they want. They have minimal, if no, insurance. They've got no real fixed overhead other than a truck. They can accept payment in cash, which allows only for partial income disclosure to the ATO, who openly admit this is a huge issue. They're saying up to 20%. I've done the maths, and if we look at taking out the tax, netting back the whole thing, there is really only a $28,000 difference if we look at the median of that group of GPs earning between 190 to 250 and those plumbers earning between 130 to 240. So yes, it's still in the favour of the GP by $28,000, and that's not including having to pay the HECS debt back, which would take an awful long time, $335,000. Now, you disagree with that analogy, I know. Tell me where that's not the case, because the perception out there is that there has been a great convergence of income between your plumber and your doctor.
Well, first of all, I've got to say you've done a fantastic job of sort of making the comparison in a way that a labour market economist would, which is in lifetime terms, you know, that you can't really just look at the salary they're earning today or at a particular age and say, oh, that's a demonstration of whether one of them's, you know, whether it's better off following this as a career or the other, as you've done, a really good job of bringing out. You also got to think about the opportunity cost of training, sort of what they give up by training for that job, and also the idea that what really matters in the end to work is there after tax income. And so he's saying, look, you know, it's one thing to say what they report their incomes are, but you've also got to think about sort of how the tax system folds into that. So I think I don't want to question the way you're thinking about this, because it's exactly the right way to think about it. I guess, yeah, my questioning was more just about and I don't dispute at all that there would be plumbers who are earning more than some GPs. I guess my response sort of when I want to think about questions like this is always to go to the Australian Bureau of Statistics data and say, what does that tell us about the situation for the markets as a whole? And so there's various sort of surveys the ABS does, which tell us about incomes of these occupations. But maybe the most recent and the best way of getting at it is a survey they do called Characteristics of Employment. So I looked at data for that in 2019. I thought it was best to look at it before COVID to get, because stuff's been messed around by COVID. And that shows that, there's various ways you could present that data, but one way to present it is that they have this top category of over $160,000. And if you look at that in 2019, according to those data, 4% of plumbers were earning above that amount. 31% of GPs were, and 57% of surgeons were, sort of. So I guess where I'm not sure about the comparison you're making is just in terms of the broader perspective on the salary data, sort of. When I look at kind of the data the ABS has, it seems to suggest to me that, that it is mainly the medical professionals who are earning the really high salaries. I should say that comparison I just gave you is restricting to full-time, just so that we're comparing sort of, because I think one thing is, in the medical profession, there's probably more part-time work because there's a greater proportion of females in the medical profession than plumbing, sort of. And so it's not as much a part-time job as some other jobs, but still there are a bigger proportion of people working part-time, which if you're just comparing sort of averages, not taking account of hours of work, matters. The other thing I just mentioned, I guess, is that when you talk about the cost of training, it's true. That at the moment the government provides subsidies sort of for apprentices, but the government also puts in a huge amount of money to medical training. The government gives University of Melbourne a lot of money sort of to pay, in addition to sort of the fees they're going to pay. The government pays a lot of money towards the training positions that they'll have in hospitals or if they're going to become specialists. So if you're kind of thinking about the government contribution that goes into training sort of, I think there's a significant... The other point as well is that, while they're at university, they're not earning, but, once they go out into the hospital system in their traineeships, then they're being paid, for working extremely hard for what they earn as trainees by all accounts. But so, I guess I haven't done the kind of the lifetime comparison of sort of earnings of plumbers and medical specialists. I agree with you that it's sort of, it's closer than just sort of saying, oh, look, this is what doctors earn in a particular year, this is what plumbers earn, because there are these differences in the cost of training which are going to bring them together.
Traditionally, wasn't that the basis of income, though? If you were educating yourself in an expensive course, whether it was costing you a lot of money or it was costing the taxpayer a lot of money, it tended, you were considered to be human capital, if you like, and you tended to be rewarded more in terms of your income than people that didn't.
That's right, and it still is. If you look broadly at the sort of categories of people who say have bachelor's degree and above, maybe have a diploma certificate, their highest qualification is completing high school, or if they haven't completed high school, there's still a very strong ordering sort of between people with those different levels of education attainment. Yeah, it's stabilized a bit in the last 15 or 20 years because, again, supply and demand pushed so many people into sort of the university. The supply of university graduates has increased.
Why have we done that?
Well, I think coming back to what we said before, I think we've done it because we saw that the way the economy was evolving, we needed more workers with these high levels of education attainment. Since the 1970s, the economy, in the 1970s, say manufacturing was 25% of employment. Now it's down, say, to 5%. The economy has been shifting increasingly towards a service type economy, which demands workers with these different types of skills. So I think the education system, sort of the government in the way it runs the education system, has really sort of responded to what it saw happening in the labour market. But coming back to the topic of plumbers, I think an issue at the moment is whether, and this is sort of something I guess you hear debated, whether we've gone too far in pushing people towards universities and whether, one of the issues about sort of trades like plumbing versus other occupations is that we're having this huge boom in construction sort of, construction sort of is just going on and on
so
and on.
We've had $3.8 billion every week pumped into the Australian economy through quantitative easing. That's gone primarily to our banks. Our banks are primarily housing funding machines in this country, and therefore that's flowed on to building of houses and renovation of houses, and that has created a whole lot more demand for trades, plumbers.
Exactly. So, Australia's population continues to grow. There's a demand for housing, increasing demand for housing. We're continually trying to catch up with that. So like you say, increased demand for plumbers. And I think, coming back to what we talked about right at the start, I said, look, there are these fundamental forces of supply and demand that mean that, medical practitioners, you're going to earn more than, say, wait staff and that. But that, then you kind of have the balance of supply and demand determining sort of where the salary of each of those groups exactly lies. And I think what's probably been happening with plumbing sort of in the last, 15 or 20 years is that the supply of plumbers hasn't been, keeping up with the demand for plumbers. It's really interesting if you actually look at the employment numbers for plumbers in the last decade have gone from 85,400 to 96,200. The numbers of GPs, according to the ABS data, have gone from 46,300 to 75,400. So in relative terms, we've had this big expansion in GPs compared to plumbers. So you can sort of believe that while I'd still probably argue that, the medical practitioners, they're going to be more, even if we take account of all the costs and that, doing better than plumbers, it seems completely sort of logical that there may have been this convergence over time driven by the fact that, the supply of plumbers hasn't been keeping up with demand, which is allowing,
So that's the explanation, isn't it? There you go. You've got the facts there. Plumbers are earning more because less of them are coming to the market compared to doctors, where we're getting a whole lot more doctors.
And of course, there's always demand for healthcare is increasing fast as well because of the ageing population and so on. So I'm not saying necessarily construction demand is growing faster than demand for medical services. But what does seem to be quite different, at least in the past decade or even going back 20 years or so, is the rate of growth in demand. I mean, even if you go back to 1987 sort of, so look at a 35-year period, basically the number of plumbers has doubled since then, 48,000 to 96,200. Number of GPs has gone from 28,600 to 75,400, so essentially tripling sort of. So I think, I hadn't looked at these numbers before, but they're really interesting in terms of this debate that we're having at the moment is, have we overdone the university a bit sort of? Do we need to be kind of, rebalancing the incentives for people to be moving into different sort of occupations and that.
Well, what about the question of migration in this? Because we can bring in qualified people in this country.
Yeah.
Presumably, some of them may need a little bit of education, some of them don't, but we've been bringing in a lot of doctors over the last few years. I don't think we've been bringing in a lot of plumbers.
Yeah, I'm not sure if plumbers are on. There are certainly workers involved in sort of construction who are getting part of sort of short-term skilled migration programs. I'm not sure whether plumbers is one of the areas as well. The kind of numbers here would suggest probably not. But I'm not sure if they're on the targeted list or not.
So if you were to start immigrating plumbers, then that would put pressure on their wages.
Yeah, that's the economic theory in that. I think. If you have an appreciable increase in supply, either because of immigration or because you're able to get, attract more people to doing plumbing apprenticeships in Australia, then that does usually sort of bring downward pressure on wages. So you'd expect that to happen.
So at the moment, we've got interest rates going up. We've got not quantitative easing anymore, but quantitative tightening, which is just another way for saying we're going to reduce the amount of money in the economic system. So maybe the demand for plumbers may decrease as a result of the economic outlook that we're having now. So if that happens, their standard of living may fall because maybe what they charge have to be more competitive, their income drops. And as a group, they will be disenchanted. Who do they turn to or blame when their standard of living drops? How will the labour market fix that problem for them?
Well, yeah, I think there's a few steps to go through there. But increasing interest rates at some stage likely to take a bit of heat out of the housing market. But, I mean, it's out of a market, that a construction market that's running very, very, you know, strongly, sort of. So, yeah, when you, I think you can take a bit of heat out of the market without necessarily causing sort of, you know, big implications for sort of the wages of, you know, tradespeople and people working in construction. Yeah, but in a worst case, you know, scenario where there's some sort of huge collapse in the construction and housing market, yeah, then I guess when you look back, that's usually seen as a pretty important sort of sector. And I think just as the government, you know, did when COVID started, mistakenly thinking that COVID would have a big negative effect on construction, I think you'd probably see government support for the construction sector to underpin sort of levels of activity there.
Okay, so what you're talking about then is someone fiddling with the laws of supply and demand.
Well, yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. Yeah, I mean, there's, in particular, we're talking about government fiddling about the laws of supply and demand. I guess that's who we're talking about, you know, doing the fiddling. And yeah, it's hard to think of a market sort of where in one way or another, the hand of government isn't influencing what happens in that market. I mean, think about, we have 25% of workers whose wages are set by awards, set through the Fair Work Commission, which is, you know, a government-established body. Government procures all sorts of goods and services, and thereby affects demand in those markets. As you said, in the medical market, the government determines how many provider numbers there are, determines sort of the, you know, the standard fee schedules and that. So government plays a huge role in markets. I mean, yeah, right at the start, you talked about the idea of venture capitalists, you know, the idea of sort of social value of work. Yeah, another example would be sort of the caring occupations and that. So if you think about, for example, aged care and the fact that, you know, at the moment there's a case running to try and increase pay of aged care workers, and a lot of people would say, wow, vital occupations sort of, you know, why aren't they paid sort of higher than they are? Well, you know, a huge amount of funding in the aged care sector is from government sort of. And so, you know, government has a very direct influence on sort of on the wages in those type of occupations, because they're really funding provision of that service.
If we had no government intervention and it was just purely the market, the labour markets determining supply and demand on their own, no intervention at all, what would happen?
I think it's actually, this may you know, seem like not the answer to the question you wanting, but the idea of a free market sort of is really, it doesn't exist sort of. Like, you have to think of government having some role sort of. Like, if you didn't have government sort of, what is there to make sure, establishing a legal system, what is there to make sure the employers actually ever pay, you know, workers, or what is there to ensure that, you know, workers are acting sort of, you know, appropriately in work? So when you talk about the role of government in markets, I don't think it's ever so much sort of like whether government will be involved. I think in any well-functioning economy, you know, government has to have a role. The question is more sort of the degree to which government intervenes. And I think, yeah, so to get to answering your question, yeah, it really depends on market by market. You can kind of predict what the effects would be if you look at what government's doing. Take that away, think what the effect would be. You know, if you're talking about the market for apprenticeships and government subsidies, take away the government subsidy, what's it going to do? Well, it's probably going to make apprenticeships less attractive and mean less people are sort of maybe moving into those, you know, moving into the occupations which are subsidised. You know, take away the regulation of award wages sort of, and yeah, then possibly sort of if those awards really are binding, then you get wages falling because the awards were putting a floor there. So I think when you think about government regulation, you've got to recognise it's sort of, you know, that it's really diverse sort of in what it does, and if you want to understand what taking that away would do, you kind of got to think about it on a case-by-case basis.
And so you would expect government, another word for politics, another word for left and right, sort of, used to be a lot more. Labor Party were the workers' party. The Liberal Party were the capitalists' party. Maybe they've diverged a bit closer, but do you still see, for example, our current federal Labor Party trying to swing a balance more toward the people who they traditionally represented in past decades?
I think, yeah, it's that politics, as you said, influenced government policy And clearly political parties have, you know, constituencies that they, you know, seek to achieve outcomes for, sort of. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty clear, isn't it, since Labor came in that they have an agenda for to do with the type of jobs that exist in the economy, to do with making jobs, you know, more secure towards the type of, you know, work, the conditions that people have to, you know, working under. So, so political parties, you know, do, when they're in government, the nature of policy they implement to affect labour markets, you know, reflects their beliefs and who they're representing. Of course, you know, I mean, there's always got to be a balance, sort of. There's a lot of, you know, any political party, you know, is always going to do stuff to a large degree as well that is just sort of, you know, good sense for the economy and good sense for all workers and everyone in the labour market, and employers as well as workers, sort of. So, but yeah, as you suggest, on the margin, there's always a shifting sort of towards your constituency.
To finish up, our two questions that I ask all of my expert guests. The first question I want to ask you is, in terms of the labour market, why are economists the heroes in assisting with the efficient running of Australia's labour market?
I don't think economists are heroes, but they're not villains either. When I saw you going to ask me this question, Ross, actually the thing that came to mind was John Maynard Keynes, who, if we're going to use the word hero, I can say is probably my hero as an economist. Keynes has this quote about how it would be great if economists could be thought of as humble and competent, like dentists. The way I kind of interpret what he's saying there is that, you know, the criterion is to be useful. If you can be thought of as useful, then that means you're doing, your occupation is doing something that's socially worthwhile, socially valuable. And I think yeah, economists are like every sort of profession, every area of knowledge. You don't get things right sort of all the time. You're always learning, always trying to improve. But I think against the standard of usefulness, sort of economics does really sort of pass that test that Keynes said. If you look at sort of Keynes himself sort of inventing the field of macroeconomics, which has given us this way to better manage the macro economy, to make sure that sort of we don't get the, you know, huge proportions of populations, of our population thrown out of work sort of when we have massive business cycle fluctuations, to, you know, make sure we're underpinning the well-being of people through sort of welfare systems. I think that economics, it's always, staying useful, because it's a moving target. Being useful is a moving target. You've always got to be sort of dealing with new challenges, updating your knowledge to try and be able to deal with those new challenges. So you can never arrive at a state where you say our discipline economics is and will always be useful. I think we can say, look, I think we've done, you know, a pretty good job at times of being useful to society, and let's keep working hard to make sure that the profession can keep making that contribution.
Do you think we're going to be more useful now that perhaps economic times have turned a bit, I'm not going to say negative, but interest rates are going up and there's been a few things that are beginning to happen that haven't happened for 30 years? Do you think the focus is going to be on economists more now? People are going to be looking, going, give me an idea what's happening?
I think the value that economists can have in times when things are uncertain and when there's a threat of sort of really severe gyrations is by helping to come back to sort of principles, to come back to economic theory, sort of to help us think through situations where there are a lot of uncertainty. And yeah, really to sort of, I guess, you know, in these kind of dramatic times, avoid the ups and downs being too bad, because, you know, you look sort of historically at what happens when you have, say, downturns, recessions that are really bad. It causes huge political instability, causes war, causes famine, all sorts of things in that. So I think the benefit of the usefulness of economists can be particularly great at challenging times by helping to sort of avoid really severe fluctuations in economic activity, which can have all sorts of, apart from just the ramifications for individuals, can have all sorts of, you know, broader ramifications which can be undesirable.
Now, our last question. It's the Bergonomics test.
Yep.
Good luck, Jeff, with this. So, you've got to take the simple hamburger. With all of your experience and expertise in labour economics, you've got to apply it to what the effects would be on our simple hamburger in terms of either anything to do with it, its pricing, its availability or whatever. in view of the labour markets?
So, yeah, I think it's a fantastic question once I started thinking about it, because so the humble hamburger, you think, oh, yeah, I know what a hamburger is. But actually, then when you start thinking about it, I think it's a great illustration of the complexity, the diversity of the labour market in a market economy. So think about what it involves to produce a hamburger. So okay, first of all, we've got the primary producers who are producing the beef that's going to go into the hamburger, and you know, maybe you've got onion in the hamburger as well, and other types of ingredients. So you've got the primary producers. You know, then you've got the processes of that, you know, the initially produced meat and the onion. And sometimes that processing might involve just processing the raw material. Sometimes if it's McDonald's and that, they're going to process to create a whole sort of prefabricated burger. Yeah, then you've got the distribution networks and that. So you've got how do you get it from the farm to the manufacturing processor? How do you get it from the manufacturing processor to the person who's going to be either selling the burger or retailing that product? Then you've got the person who's actually preparing the hamburger. So, you know, is it your local takeaway, you know, who's, you know, going to the local butchers and buying the meat and the local greengrocer sort of, or is it your upmarket restaurant where they happen to serve a hamburger and it's the three hat chef sort of is doing it, who's got the junior staff, you know, going out, or it's actually being delivered, or you've got the McDonald's sort of where it's, you know, being delivered in the big trucks and that all around Australia. And then of course you've got the cooking of it and the serving of it. Maybe the serving of it is just the person who's cooked it, handing it across the counter to the person who's bought it. But yeah, maybe it's in McDonald's where we have sort of all this infrastructure and that, where you go to buy the hamburger. Maybe it's in the restaurant where we've got the wait staff and so of output, which you and I end up consuming.
Jeff, thank you. You have identified and illuminated us on labour market economics and how we can look at it, applying it to everybody from the plumber to the doctor, the venture capitalist, to the hamburger. So thank you very much for your time. I'm sure the listeners will be a lot more educated in the area of labour economics now just because of you.
Oh, well, I hope so. And yeah, thanks very much, Ross. That was really fun.
My thanks to today's expert guest, Professor Jeff Borland, the Truby Williams Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne. Jeff publishes a fantastic newsletter called Labour Market Snapshots. His latest snapshot deals with the Great Resignation, or as he describes it, there isn't one, because the data doesn't lie. His newsletters are a great resource for anyone needing to differentiate media hype from what's actually happening. I'll publish the link on the Burgonomics website. My takeout from the podcast with Professor Borland was, the laws of supply and demand reign supreme, determining what pay we all receive for our employment. The supply of doctors, plumbers, restaurant wait staff, mechanics, or any other job description depend upon a range of factors. High educational requirements for doctors, the government's support for apprenticeships, and training programs for plumbers, and of course, the level of income each job offers. Australia's last 30 years of buoyant economic times have allowed us to pay whatever is being asked to secure the services we need. Compared to 30 years ago, there are more plumbers earning amounts close to general practitioners, but Professor Borland explained it was only a small number of plumbers. For those plumbers who are well rewarded, may I quote my own plumber of 30 years, Stuart Rose. Stuart looked at me in the eye when I quizzed him for this podcast, and he said, Roscoe, there is no amount of money that can compensate for spending a whole career elbow deep in someone else's effluent. Not a truer word has been spoken. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Burgonomics podcast and pass it on to others who you think may enjoy the demystification of economics. Thanks for listening.